October 9th. And this is the first day I've chosen to write in this journal, though I've had it with me since we made sail. As for why it's taken this long, I could claim my hands were too busy at the wheel, but I take turns in all duties with Morton, and he's found time to write. But simply put, I'm not generally one for documenting my business. However, due to the nature of this particular journey, I felt that my hand should finally be put to the page. It is for posterity's sake that we document this journey, so I shall start by noting its origins. The Shape Off the Bow by Lex H. Jones. My name is Herbert Glass, and my companion, to whom I've already referred, is Nathaniel Morton. The two of us set sail on Morton's ship, Rebecca, from the Isle of Skye. We made a northern bearing until we were clear of the last of the Scottish Isles, and then made for the northwest. Our object is an area known by sailors as the Vale. You won't find it on any map, because it's never been officially designated by those what need to see such a thing to verify its existence. But the Vale is a collection of enormous black rocks in the Atlantic Ocean, found at the midway point between Iceland and the Scottish Isles. There's no island as such, certainly nothing habitable, which begs the question of why we'd bother to sail there. It is a valid inquiry, which I'll now answer. The Vale is surrounded by fog, so thick that a man is hard put to see his hand through it, and this has led to the bitter end of many a sailor who'd not heard tell of the Vale, finding their ships rent asunder on the jagged rocks what jut from the sea like Satan's teeth. And many failed to make it back, leaving behind not only their lives, but also whatever treasures their ships carried. And there lies the origins of our expedition. Well, Morton and I once had a full crew of fishermen aboard Rebecca, and business was good. Morton and I once had a full crew of fishermen aboard Rebecca, and business was good. However, things took a turn for the complex when we decided to brighten our fortunes by smuggling the odd crate of opium. One of our number reported us to the authorities. Morton and I took the rap, for it was our decision and not the crew's to haul the powder, and we paid the fines. And thankfully, our honesty spared us jail, but lost us both crew and fishing licence. Now, upon hearing tale of an Icelandic merchant ship coming afoul of the Vale, carrying much gold and silver, bound for the government coffers, no doubt, Morton and I decided on a treasure hunt. Now, if you've read this far and think us madmen, then I do not blame you. Discarded treasures or not, why would a two-man crew task themselves with manning a ship made for 10 on a journey so arduous? Well, the logic behind that decision rests on the size of Rebecca. She's far smaller than the ships what would usually make for Iceland, and therefore easier for her to navigate the hazards of the Vale. Our goal is simply to drop anchor at a safe distance from the crashed Icelandic ship, and then take the small rowboat between her and Rebecca with as many chests as we can carry. As I write this, we've already left Scotland for the Vale, taking shifts at the wheel, giving each other a few hours at a time to sleep. The weather has been kind to us thus far, but if that turned, then I anticipate our lack of crew proving more difficult than we both anticipated. But I shan't waste worries on what's yet to occur. We may prove fortunate yet. October 10th. We've arrived. The fact of us approaching the Vale was announced via a sudden thickening of fog. There was no wind to carry it. It was as though a grey blanket surrounded the entirety of the area. We lit every fog lamp and lowered the mainsail, reducing our speed to a crawl so the rocks wouldn't catch us off guard. Tales of the place were not exaggerated. The black teeth what reach from the sea are spaced closer and closer together the farther you go, creating a deadly passage that a full-sized ship would have little hope of navigating. Even if they had a captain savvy enough to avoid tearing a great hole in the hull, the passage had become so narrow that the ship would get stuck fast. We dropped anchor soon after entering the fog, Unlike many of the poor unfortunates who'd ended their journey here, Morton and I knew what to expect, so we didn't even attempt to get deeply into the Vale. That would not have been wise. Now, I must take a moment to comment on the fog, for I will admit to being unsettled by it. I see it now, thick about the ship, curling over the deck at all sides, cold against the face in a way that feels more than simply discomforting. It's like being touched by unseen fingertips. I'm well aware that my discomfort is caused by the dread reputation of this place. Nevertheless, I will not deny its presence. Oh, but enough of this. Morton has begun unfastening the rowboat. I must assist him. October 11th. We found the ship. I'll admit, I was not expecting to write such a positive outcome. So to find the very object of our search, empty and unguarded, yet full of gold and silver, seems a product of some dream. And when I say unguarded, I mean that not a single man was aboard, living or dead. I note that last part because I had at the very least expected to have to step over some corpses of starved or injured sailors, but no, not a one. Where their bodies went, I couldn't say, and do not wish to think. And so far, we've brought 10 chests back, all full to the brim. The rowboat is small, and we do not wish to overload it, so we've taken 2 chests at a time, with 5 journeys back and forth so far. We're taking a rest now, to replenish our energies. We plan for perhaps 3 more trips today, and we'll assess again tomorrow. As I write this, the clock tells me it's only mid-afternoon. I find that surprising, as I would have sworn it was later. Yet the sky within the Vale is permanently grey, the fog what fills it, blocking out any further light that might break through. Time has no meaning here. I could see a man going mad if he were to stay too long. I'm increasingly grateful that we'll be gone in a couple of days. October 11th, second entry. We made 2 more of our planned journeys for the day when calamity struck. As we rowed back to Rebecca, the rowboat rocked to the left and I jarred my elbow against a passing rock. Nothing broke, but the force of the blow was such that I couldn't move my left arm strong enough to row. Whilst I rested it and inspected the damage, Morton fixed his gaze on the high walls of the black rock to either side of us. They seemed to be looming in over our heads as though we sat in the palm of some great stone hand. 'Twas a trick of the light, of course, but that knowledge and rationale made the thought no less disturbing, particularly given the heightened state of my senses following my injury. Morton stared at the rock as though it were hypnotising him. He seemed lost in it. You know, he actually left the rowboat and climbed onto the rock closest to us, walking along the narrow edge until he stood before this sheer surface. He stared into this as though admiring a mountain of gold, even seemed to be caressing it. I called after him, but he didn't respond. The rock seemed now like a wall of black ice or a mirror what reflected no light. It hadn't appeared that way when he first climbed ashore, I'm quite certain. But now it was smooth and glistening. Something moved inside it. Or perhaps not inside in the strictest sense, but reflected within it. The way an image seen through a telescope's not truly within the telescope, but merely seen through the use of it. I tried to assure myself that it was merely Morton's reflection, distorted by the rock's unusual properties. didn't quite believe it, though. I still don't. Eventually, I yelled loudly enough that Morton was snapped from his dreamlike state, and he joined me back in the rowboat. I asked what he'd seen in the rock, but he said he'd seen nothing and was just studying the composition of it. I don't know why he'd lie, but his answers didn't seem like his own somehow, nor his voice. It was almost as though something else was speaking for him at that moment. Well, Morton got us back to Rebecca, and I climbed the ladder somewhat haphazardly. We used the winch to help bring up the chest. After that, it seemed best to rest my arm for the night. We'll see in the morning how much pain it still causes me, and assess the chances of us making any further journeys to the merchant ship. If it seems unfeasible, we shall raise the anchor and sail for home. October 12th. Morton has gone. It's 2 in the morning as I write this, and he's not aboard. We share a cabin. His bunk is less than 2 feet from mine, yet why didn't hear him rise nor leave the ship? The rowboat's gone too. My sleep is usually light. I'm easily awoken, yet something kept me fast within the grips of dream this night. I called out his name repeatedly, shouting into the fog. My own voice echoes back at me from the veil, but no other sound or movement is offered. I've no way of going in there after him. There's but the one rowboat and no life rafts. Well, I could climb down and attempt to swim, but to where? The sea's rough and deathly cold, and even a man at full strength would struggle to survive long in it. No. There's nothing I can do but wait for him to come back. If I were a faithful man, I might pray, but I've never had cause to believe in such higher powers. I lament that fact now, as I sit alone, in the dark. October 12th, second entry. Morton is dead, but he returned after a fashion. I must have drifted off while sitting waiting for him, and I was awoken from my slumber by the rowboat bumping repeatedly against Rebecca's hull. I looked over the starboard side to see the boat bobbing on the waves, Morton lying flat upon it, facing upwards. I thought at first that he was sleeping, that perhaps the effort of rowing the boat all alone had tired him out, that he hadn't the energy to climb back onto the ship. How could one sleep on such a small boat in the icy night was beyond me, but it remained my first assumption. That was until I climbed down the ladder. My arm felt numb now, but not as painful as it had the night before, and I was able to descend the ladder to reach the rowboat. The intention was to wake Morton and help him attach the winch to raise it. That was when I saw his face. Oh, he was the colour of chalk. All the blood of the life drained from him. But worse still were his eyes. Dear Lord, his eyes. Well, they were gone. Completely gone. No blood, no rips in the skin, no burn marks. His eyes were just gone, replaced by hollow black pits. His mouth was much the same, wide open in horror as it was. His hands were raised before him as though he were trying to shield himself or keep something back, the fingers gnarled and locked in their position. I felt bile rising in my throat. Every fibre told me to get back up there, raise the anchor and be gone from this hellish place forever. I couldn't leave. Whatever fate had befallen him, I couldn't leave Morton's corpse like that. Not here. No. I had to get him back to England so he might see a proper burial. The effort of raising the rowboat, with Morton's weight added to it, even with the winch, was tiring beyond words. I could do naught else, though. I've not laid him in the cabin, for I couldn't stand to share the darkness with that corpse as I slept. And if that makes me seem cold, then I beg forgiveness. But instead, I left him in the rowboat, secured it firmly and covered it up with a tarp tight enough to keep the rain out. He'll rest there right enough till I find him a burial spot back home. And a grand spot it'll be. The treasure will see to that. October 14th. There was a shape off the bow. It's not there as I write this now, else I'd be too afraid to turn my eyes from it. But it lingered long enough for me to be assured I was not just imagining it. I set a southeasterly course to take me back to the Scottish Isles and home from there, but in truth I'd expected the act of leaving the Vale to be more troublesome than it was. The unnatural place has taken hold in my mind, giving rise to visions of sudden storms and violent seas, of becoming lost in the fog and finding myself facing those black rocks again and again. But no, none of this has occurred. I was able to depart even more easily than we'd arrived. I speak to Morton often. Perhaps this seemed morbid, or even the beginnings of insanity, but I find it comforting to think that in some capacity he is still here. Or I did. I was at the wheel when I saw the shape appear, less than 10 feet ahead of the bow. It was hovering, perhaps 20 feet above Rebecca. I thought I was viewing a torn rag at first, some filthy scrap caught in the wind or attached to a loose rope or cable perhaps, for that was the shape of it, but no. The movement of the thing betrayed the fact it was tethered to nothing. It floated of its own accord, keeping pace with the ship, a spirit, or so it seemed. I couldn't see a face, so there was no way to tell where it was looking. I feel, as though it was looking ahead, though, helping to guide the ship. At least that's the tale I tell myself, for to believe it was staring back at me constantly is too great a fear to cope with in my isolated position. The best way I can describe it is as though a black or a brown sheet, torn and tattered throughout, had been thrown over a grown man and billowed about him in the wind, yet nothing was visible beneath it. I could see no feet, yet I was sure that the thing had black, withered hands protruding from that cloak. I mentioned Morton before, and I should clarify how this shape brought his presence to mind, for, you see, I believe it is him. Or rather, his spirit come to guide me home. And true, it does not resemble him in shape, and its countenance or the feeling that I get from it don't remind me much of the man I sailed with for so many years, but should it necessarily be so? What form is one set to take after death? I can't know this any more assuredly than any other man could honestly claim to. It's not reappeared since I dropped anchor for the night. The winds are light at present, and I could perhaps safely have set the wheel and let the ocean carry me on through the night, but I dare not risk it. The weather could change. A stray boat might be passing this way, despite the shipping chart stating otherwise. I wouldn't sleep thinking I was sailing blind through waters I knew so poorly, so I'd rather lose the time by dropping anchor each night. My eyes grow weary now, and I must cease writing and douse the candle. Yet, if I may be honest, which a man must surely be when he writes solely from his own thoughts, I am reluctant to do the latter. To leave the cabin in darkness is a thought that chills me. No, I shall let the candle burn down as it will, while I sleep. October 15th. It is not Morton. I'm sure of it now, for I found his journal. As I've written in these pages, he commenced documenting the day's events far earlier than I did, a task which he continued with right up until the night he took the rowboat into the Vale alone. I do not believe I can adequately justify my decision to read his journal. These were his private thoughts, after all, his own documentation of his life as he saw it. They were not words meant for another. Yet I find that I had to read what he'd written, not for the entirety of the trip, but merely the night he went to his doom. He made an entry that night, which finished the moment before he left. His accuracy in describing what he felt did not leave me wanting, although it did bring a renewed chill to my bones. Morton's writings reveal that he had seen it, the shape. His description of it matches my own. There's no doubt that we witnessed the same apparition, meaning, of course, that it cannot be him. But more than this, his experience of it was different to my own. I merely saw it hovering off the bow and keeping pace with the ship. Morton says that it led him into the Vale. His writings describe a song, like the sirens of legend, that he couldn't ignore. Not a pleasant, enchanting music, but merely something that he felt that he must follow. And he had little option to do aught else. Whether the shape was the source of the music or simply working in an accompaniment with it, Morton doesn't make clear, but then how could he have known? His last writing is the statement of his intention to follow the shape and the song back into the Vale. He contemplates waking me, but decides against it. He was looking out for me, even at the end. And precisely what befell him next is knowledge Morton took with him to the grave. But had I to venture a theory, I'd say that he saw something in that glistening black surface on the rock. More, I think that whatever he saw there latched onto him somehow and followed him back to the ship, only to lead him back later to his doom. But why? When I saw it myself, it was content to let the ship sail where it would, trying in no way to lead me back to the Vale. I do not, and perhaps never will, understand. But I shall keep my candle lit this night, and most likely every night for the rest of my life. October 15th, second entry. Morton came to me in a dream. It was not a pleasant one, but I'm sure it was revelatory. In it, I was asleep in my bunk, just as I was in reality. I heard Morton call my name, as he often would when a stray thought occurred to him late in the night. I turned to see him lying across from me in his own bunk. I didn't know that I was presently in a dream, as one so rarely does, and so I didn't react with any horror. Morton sat up in his bunk, and I saw the serrated fishing knife in his hand.
"It wants to leave," he said.
And then he stuck the blade into the side of his own neck. Well, I woke violently from the dream, my body coated in sweat despite the cold air of the cabin. My breathing was heavy and my heart raced, but my mind was clear and focused. I had to look more closely at Morton's body. Well, I could see the rain driving against the cabin window, but I didn't bother dressing before walking out into the deck. I just wrapped my greatcoat tightly about my night clothes. I took a lantern and I walked to the rowboat, unfastening the tarp at one side. I had to choke back the horror as I was greeted once more by Morton's horrific condition. I didn't want to spend any longer than I had to in such close proximity to it. But I had to be sure. Leaning closer, I tugged aside the collar of Morton's coat to get a look at the side of his neck. Sure enough, a gaping wound was present there. The fishing knife no longer protruded from it, but it had surely been the cause of it. Morton had killed himself, and seconds later, something had drained the life from him. Did whatever he saw in the black shining surface compel him to take his own life? Did the shape? Perhaps they're somehow one and the same. I don't know, but I feel that I must learn somehow. Morton came to me in a dream so that I might understand. Evidently he felt it important enough to reach out, even beyond death. A thought came to me as I stood beside that wretched corpse which had once been my truest of friends. When had he taken his own life? Had he rowed the boat back to Rebecca and then done the deed? Was the rowboat carried back to the ship by good fortune, or did another, more sinister hand ensure that the rowboat made it back here? And was it carrying more than Morton's corpse? As I replaced the tarp, something moved in my periphery. I turned sharply to see the shape floating above the ship, just off the bow once more. Only this time it was turned towards me. I could see that its head was shrouded by a hood, and shadowed beneath that hood was a face. I raised my lantern to get a better view of the thing, and I immediately regretted it. The light passed mostly through the shape, as though it were not entirely there. We might expect such from a spectre, based on the stories we've all heard, but I don't believe this to be the spirit of a departed man. But not anymore. I don't think there ever was anything human about the shape. A theory that was confirmed when the lantern beam lit upon it, and I was briefly able to see its face.
Lord, its face! The sight of that dreadful countenance sent me running back to my cabin, where I closed the door behind me and I pushed my personal chest against it.
October 15th, final entry. I don't know what came over me last night. My previous entry into this journal was strange and worrying. I mentioned having suffered a nightmare, and I think that must surely have confused my thoughts. I can laugh about it now, but I'm glad nobody was here to see it. All will be well soon enough, for dry land is only a few days away. October 16th. I did not write the previous entry in this journal. Now I know how that statement must surely read, and that my very sanity will now be in doubt. The words are written in my hand so perfectly that even I would be fooled by them, were it not for the fact that I know I did not write them. They contradict my every feeling about the current situation. I suspect that was the malevolent intention of the words, for whilst I believe that it may have been my own hand what wrote it, it was not under the direction of my own free will. That thing possessed me. I am more sure of this than I have any right to be, but I know it to be true. I have thought much on the matter, for I am unable to do much else. I believe that whatever Morton saw in that black rock in the vale is in fact trapped there, whether within the rock itself or in whatever place that shining black surface was a window into. I can't say for sure, but this is where the shape truly lies. Yet somehow it was able to send a shade of itself out into the world to lure Morton to it. Now I believe its intention was to take hold of him and to walk in his flesh, but Morton's suicide stopped that. Sadly, not before the shape was able to draw enough life from him to escape the veil. For it is here, now, with me. It is unknown to me what the shape hopes to achieve by travelling the land. Has it been there before? There must be a reason it would banish to wherever its body now resides. Whatever that reason, I can't imagine it would be in any way beneficial for the human race. And that is why I've taken a decision that does not come easily to me. I must go back. I must return to the veil and somehow stop this thing from leaving. I've no intention of taking my own life, but if there is no other way, I don't know, and I cannot say. But if it is within my power, even if it is the last thing I do, I must trap it there once more. October 17th. Well, how I laugh when I read that previous entry. To think I was so clear last night that I wanted to return to that place of shadows and strange angles. No, I don't wish to see that ever again. I keep calling it the Veil, but well, that's not its true name. That can't be written down with this crude language. No, I will not return there. I will not. My course is set for England, that old country which, as I write this, sits at the head of an empire that governs much of the world. There is power there and security. I look forward to seeing it. Morton will not be making this journey with me. I decided that a burial at sea was more fitting for him. I've no wish for the dock workers to see his corpse and question what might have happened to him. It is a more peaceful end for him this way. I shall say he died at the Veil, which many have done before him, so that's hardly suspicious. I shall miss my friend, for he was a great boon to me. But my thoughts now turn to England. I look forward to feeling dry land beneath my feet again. It has been so very, very long. The Shape Off the Bow was written by Lex H. Jones and performed by Dion Winton Pollock. Copyright 2020. It was created as part of the Whistling Past the Graveyard collection for Bidditzo Books. Whistling Past the Graveyard is available to purchase from Amazon. The music on this recording came from the Free Music Archive under the Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial License. The intro music was called The Fifth Life by Circus Marcus. The outro music was called Post Bellum by D. Yan Key. The ocean was provided by Clank Beeld at freesound.org under the same Creative Commons License. The Shape Off the Bow was a Fine-Toothed Comb production.